Hear well.
I can hear you.
You can hear me well.
The stream is live. I think we did it.
Oh, shit. We're already live. All right.
All right. Just saw it pop. All right.
Let's get going.
Welcome to another episode of PBJ. How are you guys doing?
Good. Great. We're just talking about how many things we had to talk about.
It's a lot today. It's also kind of hot. I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, hot slash very nice, but I'm like sweaty coming over today. So, you know.
You walked over.
Feeling
right?
Good, though. Yeah, well, we're not going to be doxing anyone.
DK's jetpacked over. DK is fortunate that he doesn't have to be in the same room with your sweat.
Exactly. But. Yeah. I'm sure I smell lovely. Bro, you come on here after bike rides and stuff. Like,
all right. I've yet.
Speaking of doxing,
have I worn my bike kit yet? I don't think I have.
Yeah.
You were biking out.
Maybe once.
Once or twice.
I thought you wore it once.
Maybe once.
Yeah, I feel like once. We've got the video footage and we've got that AI tool that Ashu built. Can it do an export?
Yeah, I brought it up last week and like dropped the alpha, and then you guys played with it afterwards.
It was good,
isn't it good?
It was really. I mean, kudos to Ashu. It was really, and that was his first thing he's ever built, right?
Yeah,
that's sick.
I think it's very slick. Yeah, so now there were 5 episodes uploaded for us to test, and we're gonna get all the content in there now and make it available to others.
And just for those who didn't hear last week, what exactly is this? Just like a
We've done like 60 episodes of this now. I think this is either 59 or 60, but we've done a lot. So there's like 100 hours of content. And we talk about a lot of topics, right? AI, vibe coding, Bitcoin, etc. So often I'll want to go back, like someone asked me about something we had a really good discussion. When was it? And what timestamp in the video? And even though I participated in it, it still takes me like minutes, if not tens of minutes, to find it. So that's obviously a barrier. So this is a website, which is like a topic index. So I can go to, I want to talk about OpenClaw.
Yeah.
Or I want to go find out when did we talk about OpenClaw.
Right.
So I just look up OpenClaw or search for OpenClaw. And then it has every episode where we talk about it and linked right to the timestamp. It's just makes that process super simple.
Beautiful. We should drop that in the show notes today.
Yeah.
Whenever Ashu's ready.
Yeah. Maybe next week. We'll launch it soon. Yeah.
It's amazing. I think it's really well done. And I think it actually points toward a future that, you know, I think we could collectively all be thinking about, which is, you know, like Ashu has been doing that kind of work and trying to make those clips. And he's been doing that as a manual process. And it's pretty frustrating, I think, if you have to do a little bit of a grind of the same thing every day. Totally. So nobody like told him, hey, let's go make a thing. I assume you didn't. I don't know. I didn't suggest it. But he sort of picked it up.
Like,
he
said, hey, I'm the ultimate. I'm the ultimate PM. Yes.
Okay.
I PM this into existence.
Yeah.
But I think there's
the reason why I even knew or like Bitcoin Optech, which is something I helped found and run many years ago. Created a similar topic index because David Harding wrote like 250 weeks of newsletters, like super detailed technical stuff, and it was like overwhelming to like go try to find something, and that's where the idea came from. Sorry to cut you off.
Well, all I was saying is, you know, it was nice that you gave that nudge and kind of, you know, shared that could be done, but I think almost everybody, whatever your job is, you are doing something that's probably a little bit of a grind, or it's maybe not your most exciting part of your day. And you could think about what kind of tool you could build to help you do it better. And so in a sense, you don't think so much, hey, is AI replacing my work? But how do I just make my work better by using AI? I think
I do have to ask one question on that, which is, even though I think it's sick and super hats off to Ashu and everyone in the PB that's like vibe coding and building stuff now, even though that's sick for today, like, are we also just at a point where you just basically, like, let's say you have Claude or OpenClaw running, just be like, yo, just find this clip. Like, even the tools are amazing, but like, how far away are we from where, like, you don't even need the tools? You're just like, I have my one agent.
I can see that coming quickly.
I think there's a path.
But that's fine. But I mean,
I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just
is it here and now? Actually, DK, or we wanted to talk about, we had a builder meetup last night. So we wanted to talk about that. And it's a good segue to that.
Yeah.
Because another really good example of what you just mentioned, DK, is what Haley did yesterday. And I think it's so exciting what she did. So, you know, she doesn't have a programming background, but she's definitely been experimenting with these different tools. And yesterday she had there was like a practical need or experience she wanted to create for the builder meetup, which was she wanted people to be able to, because we've been running a raffle the past few months where we give out a BitKey. And she wanted to move from like a physical process for the raffle tickets to digital. So she vibe coded, she's cloud code, vibe coded a really compelling experience, both for the administrator and for the participants. And she weaved in promotional activities for Presidio Bitcoin. So to enter the raffle, you had to go, you know, scan a QR code, go to this website she created. You then needed to subscribe to Presidio Bitcoin Media, like our show. So pump our numbers, as well as her own 21 and 21 podcast she does. And then also, what was the other? You had to sign up for the Presidio Bitcoin newsletter. And then once you, or you had to like give checkbox to give permission to sign up and provide your email, then you hit submit, and then you got a raffle ticket.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the night, she used her admin tool that she created to randomly select the winners. And there was a good visualization. It showed a digital like jar and everyone's name was in the jar. That's cool. It was just, it was tasteful, high taste, pragmatic, useful, promoted Presidio Bitcoin well. And a feature request I had, and I hope we do in a future one, is I've always wanted to encourage people who visit Presidio Bitcoin to get a spending wallet on their phone.
That's a good point.
Because, you know, I think most people who come through here, even if they're not a Bitcoiner, they probably own Bitcoin, but they might just hold it on Coinbase or something. So I'd like to encourage people to have Bitcoin on their phone, right? So one way to do that is like, give an incentive to spend a Bitcoin here at Presidio Bitcoin. Of course, we could do a store or something like that. But the idea with registration is like, you know, you get bonus raffle tickets, like a 2x or a 3x bonus if you spend just one Bitcoin. And when I say one Bitcoin, I mean a sat. Meaning like, you know, a tiny amount. We're not trying to like make money off this. We just want to get you to the point where you can pay one Bitcoin.
Have the experience.
You know, and so there is friction. You have to like be like, oh, how do I do that? Which wallet do I download? And make a decision on that and then install it and then transfer Bitcoin into it. So there is a cost there. But hopefully like, you know, bonus raffle tickets and maybe getting a BitKey. Also Maple AI came in with prizes last night. So there's like so much enthusiasm for the builder meetup that we have multiple sponsors now, and I suspect more. We're gonna have to come up with a process to figure out who all gets to be giving away stuff at Builder. But yeah, I think it would be cool to be able to spend, you know, have people spend Bitcoin, get extra raffle tickets and extra chances to win. But
I love it.
Back to the point with what Haley built, I just think it's cool that she built it in less than a day. I mean, she started building it yesterday, finished it and had it ready to go, and it worked last night. I think that's amazing.
And she did it without your need to PM it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I had nothing to do with this. So
that's cool. Would she use Cloud Code or was she using Ori or
Cloud Code?
Cloud Code.
Yeah. So
I'm curious just because I think a lot of people are beginning.
I don't know. She was talking Vercel and Supabase with me. So,
Go
Haley.
I just so proud of her because, like,
cool. Yeah, that's great.
You know, go back 6 months ago, she wouldn't have any idea what any of these things are or how it all works. And it's not just Cloud Code doing all the work. I mean, she's leveled up her knowledge to how to architect this, how to build it and make it happen. So, super cool.
Super cool. Yeah.
And then, so that was a cool aspect last night. Another really cool aspect last night was, you know, we started Builder last summer. We've done, 8 or so now. It's always been intended to be, you know, a bigger tent welcoming builders. It doesn't, you don't have to be a dev. You can be any kind of, you know, career skill you can attend. You also don't have to be a Bitcoiner. In fact, we want non-devs. We want non-Bitcoiners to come to this explicitly. So we've done decent at that historically, but still dominated by people who would call themselves Bitcoiners, I think. But last night was the exact opposite, it was amazing. There's a few reasons. I mean, the vast majority of people had never been to Presidio Bitcoin. I don't think would call themselves Bitcoiners. But they came and I think had a really, really positive experience.
Definitely.
It's similar to the Type 1 Energy Summit that you organized, Max, but even more so. And why? Well, one is it was marketed as, I mean, it was about OpenClaw, right? So it was marketers OpenClaw, that attracted people who, you know, maybe don't care about Bitcoin, but they were very interested in OpenClaw. And number two, because it was about OpenClaw, Luma, which is the invitation service we use now, they added like an OpenClaw tag. And I think, you don't have control over doing that. Other than the content you put in the invites, that happened. And then I don't know if it was because of Luma or other reason, but OpenClaw has some kind of like event directory. And we were added to that. And we were on like the front page of that. So it just
and the dude retweeted it.
Yeah.
The OpenClaw.
The founder of OpenClaw retweeted not our event, but the event directory.
Which our event was on.
Yeah, which we're on the front page. So
it's cool.
We got great marketing exposure. I think Haley said 90 to 100 RSVPs.
Wow.
We can only comfortably fit 60 or 70 people in this space. So we actually had to capped it at 75 and then everything over that was waitlist and didn't get invited. In reality, I think 40, 45 came. So not surprising that there's quite a bit of attrition on a weeknight on a free event. So we'll learn from that and maybe not cap it at 75, but cap it a little higher. But still, phenomenal turnout, mostly non-Bitcoiners. I think everyone had a good experience. What was discussed? Well, Jesse Posner, who's member at Presidio Bitcoin and an entrepreneur here working on Vora, he gave a presentation to begin with, and it introduced OpenClaw, it focused on security considerations, and then he got into what he and his co-founder Eric are building at Vora, and what turned out to, we can talk about it, but yeah, both great. Max and I were I was really proud of Jesse. I thought
me too.
Astounded by the strong vision he painted, and how compelling it was, not just to like hardcore Bitcoiners, but I think to a broad audience. I think it was received well by the audience as well. And I guess we've known Jesse's journey with Vora and where it started, which was very Bitcoin specific.
Yeah.
And even though we're all about Bitcoin, it felt like a small market, and now where they've where their journey's led them to, I think is pretty compelling.
Yeah. I have two things to say on all that. First of all, I mean, definitely shout out to Jesse. I've obviously watched him extremely closely over the last year, I guess, or year or so that it's been. And I think both of us would agree this was by far the best pitch he's ever given by like at least one, maybe two orders of magnitude. Like he and Eric have come so far in explaining why this matters. I think though, as one sort of comment about the event itself, you know, I think it's really important to stress what you were just saying. People came out because, you know, for a variety of reasons that are beyond our control, the stuff we've talked about on the show, privately, whatever, like sadly, Bitcoin has a lot of baggage with it, the word Bitcoin. All the crypto crap and the scammers and the Web3 and nothing we want to be associated with, it has a lot of baggage. And so I think, you know, whenever you market an event as Bitcoin, people are like, oh, it's just the scammy thing. Because this was an OpenClaw event, but it was an OpenClaw event focused on Bitcoiner principles, things like, how do I make sure my data is sovereign? How do I make sure, you know, that eventually I'll be able to have my agent participate in free markets, things like that. I think I would say, from what I could tell, everyone left having learned something, getting excited. But it was like, I think it just stresses the way for us to really build that bridge is to, like, again, let Bitcoin fade to the background. Like, how do you find where there are new exponential waves in society? Get people in the door by focusing on that. And once they're here, realize there's nothing scammy we're talking about. It's all like, you know, Jesse came across as someone who's an expert cryptographer who's, you know, secured billions of dollars at Coinbase at BitKey. So anyway, so I just think that's like a really important thing for us as a show, as a community here at PB, is like the more Bitcoin fades to the background, the more Bitcoin is going to succeed, is my take.
Yeah, let me just triple down on that, because I agree. The way Jesse presented himself and the whole presentation, it was not a hardcore Bitcoin presentation. Bitcoin really wasn't mentioned at all, except for where he tied his past experiences to the present solution, which I thought was really well done. And the reality is that those are super important to the solution he's building.
Exactly.
Anyway, and I think we just see more and more instances of where this is succeeding.
Yes.
In reaching the audience we care about, just a broader tech industry. And it doesn't mean we're brushing Bitcoin to the side. It's just Bitcoin to us, I think, is just like, it's just part of the internet. It's internet money. It's woven. It's just like we don't hold events for like TCP/IP.
Exactly.
And invite everyone who wants to talk about TCP/IP.
Exactly. Right? Hey, TCP/IP. Hello, fellow TCP/IP enthusiasts.
Yeah. All right. And that's actually, for years now, I write Bitcoin with a small b.
Right.
And if you look at the history of the internet, it started off with a capital I and it switched to a little I because it's
normal.
Yeah, it's normalized. It's just part of existence, sort of. Yeah. And I think, Bitcoin wasn't there yet and it still isn't there yet, but I mean, I'm sort of, that's my small way I'm trying to like will that into the world.
I love that.
Little
I love that. So the other thing that I want to mention, I think, as a sort of follow-up on that, specifically to Jesse's presentation, I think the biggest thing that changed, obviously he's improved his thinking on things. And there was a really cool vision about, you know, in the future where you could use Bitcoin for things like having your agent participate in free markets, whatnot. But the biggest thing, and I think this is a learning for all of us, was something that was outside of his control. And that was, in the past, if you listen to this pitch 6 months ago, it was like, oh, you know, people are really going to care about their data and their privacy. And it's kind of like the Bitcoiners being like, yeah, you're really going to care about money. It's like, no one cares until there's a 2008 financial crisis, then everyone cares a lot. Or until there's, you know, hyperinflation in Argentina, then everyone cares a lot. Same thing with this. Like, you try to explain to people in the abstract, it's like, there will come a day when you want to have your own hardware to manage your agent. And it's like, it's very hard to think about these things just conceptually. But because of the open claw explosion, that to me is what gave them their window. Now, you know, there's a concept. Anjali showed me this YC podcast with the Claude Code guy. It's really good. I highly recommend it. And one of the things he kept stressing in building Claude Code was this concept of latent demand, which is like, if you're doing a startup or anything, he literally said this like 10 times in the podcast over and over. If you can find an activity that people are already doing and you can just make it easier, faster, better for them to do that, that's how you win. Trying to create new activity out of nowhere, very, very, very difficult. Not impossible, but very, very difficult. And in this case, and with, you know, Jesse and Eric, now that normies are trying to run their own agents to go out there and mess around the internet. You know, Mac minis are flying off the shelf. There is latent demand. There's a real activity people are doing, which is buying new hardware to run their agents. And then Jesse just gave a fabulous presentation where he's like, look, you know, all these people think they're doing something safe by putting it on their computer and then give it access to their Gmail and their credit card and their social security number. Mm-hmm. Like, what could go wrong? And like, by the end of that, I mean, I was pretty like, oh shit, like I would never run one of these things. I think a lot of people felt that way as well. And this Jesse's sort of response is, if you want to be able to run your own agent, have an agent that really represents you, is this concept of the fiduciary duty of agent. You need confidentiality and you need to make sure it's like basically air gapped. And I think that the problem, and then he went through a solution, which is very interesting, having like an open source model running locally that can then deal with models in the cloud, which I thought was very interesting as well. So you could have the best of Claude with your own local open source model. But the big thing that changed now is, I think people are in a state where they're ready to have their own models. They're already buying unique hardware because they think it's going to protect them and it doesn't. And now he can solve that problem.
Well, and I don't think we've even really framed the whole opportunity. So right now, people have a lot of data exposed to in the cloud. You have a lot of data with Google, with Facebook, Instagram, Amazon, TikTok, etc. And you know, there's like security and privacy concerns with that. The evidence is people generally don't care. People have gotten so much value out of these services and they haven't felt enough pain from the security and privacy trade-offs they've made. But, you know, there's certainly people, and we've discussed it for years, but there's people who have a vision for like bringing all that data onto your own personal server. And there's certainly been startups that have attempted to do that. I remember, DK, you've definitely met with some of them in the, like maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I think OpenClaw, as Max just pointed out, is this moment where people are, I mean, just the power of AI and then the audaciousness of OpenClaw giving this immense power with like sort of no safety controls at all, are starting to show the power of if you hoover up all this data about yourself, put it on a computer you control, you have control of that data now, and then the power that comes with it. Because now you have all that data in one place and it can be analyzed by, you can have a local AI model analyze it and have that. It's just super powerful. So as Jesse said in this presentation, this will be so powerful, so seductive that like everyone's going to do it. Like you are at a serious disadvantage in life if you don't do this. And then when you do it, then you have like a digital me. Like, you know, you have a second version of yourself and it's mm-hmm. like more powerful than it's ever been created before. So that's amazing, but it's also extremely scary if you're subject to like prompt injection attacks and like, you know, just revealing all that information to the internet. It could be absolutely, absolutely devastating. So that's sort of the premise of what Vora is trying to solve now is,
so is it something
enable that power, but do it in a secure way with fiduciary
duties. So it's fair to say it's like a wrapper on OpenClaw that lets you run in a more hardened way? Is that a reasonable way to summarize what's happening?
I think it's personal hardware. It's more like a personal server. And you could run something like an OpenClaw, although I think he's thinking maybe beyond OpenClaw specifically, but this idea like you want your personal assistant air-gapped on hardware that you can prove is air-gapped.
I see. And then you'd mentioned kind of the like an open source local LLM that would be running on that hardware, and then it would be reaching maybe another OpenClaw instance or somewhere else that has maybe other types of LLMs in the cloud.
Well, this is I didn't fully understand all of this architecture, so this would be a good sort of maybe a chance to have Jesse. Maybe I should know their ideas from the edge of them or something. But basically, yes, your open source local model is kind of your like protector, like your like DK's guardian, I think is what he called it.
Mm-hmm.
But like
bodyguard, yeah.
Like your bodyguard. But that AI, you know, no matter how good local gets, there's probably always gonna be better ones in the cloud. And so the idea is how can that AI communicate or orchestrate a fleet of like Claude code bots mm-hmm. that operate in such a way where they can build things for you, but without having access to your like private keys or a social security number.
One big question I have in this whole thing, and you know, without necessarily fully hearing about the architecture, maybe it's not even clear yet. But one thing I think I must have had, you know, 4 or 5 hours of calls with various entrepreneurs working on effectively like OpenClaw on your desktop, right, in some form, and just in the last week. And one thing that I keep asking, and I think is super important, but nobody really seems to have thought much about is how should auth work?
Yeah.
And so is like today I use 1Password to manage all my passwords. I have, you know, good passwords and unique passwords on every website, et cetera. And if I think I've not installed OpenClaw locally on my actual daily driver Mac because I'm, you know, all the problems, but I've done it in the cloud, but it's not useful in the cloud, right? So, meaning if it's just some cloud instance, I can do stuff with it, but I can't actually do stuff with my stuff, which is right. kind of frustrating. So what is the answer to the auth story? How should auth evolve for this era?
I mean, I think that's a major question. I think different people are taking different approaches. I think Anthony and Marks are doing something slightly different with what they're building at Maple AI, which is more cloud first. They probably thought more about the auth. From what I understand from Jesse's perspective, though, he thinks that like all of these like things you're seeing right now with people claiming, oh, we'll give you better auth and safety and stuff. He thinks that's basically all like the Ethereum version. It's all like just vaporware.
Security theater,
exactly. And so his point is like, if you actually want what you're talking about, you need to like have like air gap chips. Like, I mean, this is where he started talking about like, you know, Faraday cages and like basically going kind of hardcore Bitcoiner ethos. But I think he's right, which is like, you need to be able to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that like basically your private keys are, or whatever the secrets are, air gap from everything else at the hardware level and be able to have the attestations there.
Sure. So I get that. Let's assume that that is true and built and available. But then, you know, let's say I have a task, like I have an OpenClaw that's local and I want to say something like, hey, you know, go gather up all of my financial statements and all the details I need from, you know, a dozen different providers so I can send it to my tax guy or he needs to do my taxes. Yeah. So I need to click around a bunch of websites, log into a bunch of stuff, grab a bunch of documents, et cetera. And so is there like, today I would need to use one password. I need those credentials to be able to log into those websites. Is there a path for how that should work in an OpenClaw world?
I think that's maybe part of their secret sauce, but I'm not sure. That's okay. Something that would be good to hear more on. So,
okay.
One other thought that I want to mention this, actually, there's a couple things that are coming up in the chat, but I do want to pause though and say why I think there's certainly a path to having your own sort of fiduciary AI. And I do think there's going to be a spectrum. I think there's going to be some people that want it, you know, sort of the Bitcoin paranoid version, like attestations, physical hardware, Faraday cages. I also think that like Maple AI, what they're doing is, you know, that's kind of like that middle ground where you're still trusting a cloud service, but in theory, as long as you trust Amazon, you know, and they're using their trusted execution environment. And I know Anthony and those guys are going to have some new updates on that front as well. So I think you're going to see a whole spectrum and different people, depending on their level of, you know, paranoia, their level of like whatever secrets they're guarding, maybe we'll choose different versions there. But I also thought that, I forget his real name now, but good enough.
Damien,
thank you. Yeah. that Damien's, you know, his take on how he's using OpenClaws was very interesting to me, which is basically to say, you know, it's one thing you need all these protections if you're trying to create the second me, the second DK, Steve, or Max, whatever. But like his take has been like, don't create the second me, just like only focus for now on just creating like new entities. And yeah, he basically talked about how whenever he's running these agents, like, you know, he gives them, you know, their own GitHub accounts. They don't get his. Mm-hmm. And okay. I think honestly, until all this other stuff gets worked out, that to me seems like by far the best idea. Like I would not be trying to create a second me until Warren, Maple, and whoever else has all the solutions mm-hmm. ready. I think Damien's approach is probably best.
Yeah. So, I mean, overall, I thought Builder was amazing last night. Haley did a great job sort of making it all happen. Jesse was crucial to it.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing to market as like OpenClaw or non-Bitcoin stuff, but we got to deliver too.
And, yeah,
Jesse delivered. Like it was quality content.
And not just Jesse. I mean, Jesse, Damien, and Dustin afterwards, they all did a panel together as well. It was great, like all the way around. So,
for sure.
So two things I want to call out from the chat, because I think this is interesting. One, is from Austin. What's up, Austin? Long time. Day zero PBJ guy.
Hey,
he says PBJ needs a nice vending machine that only accepts Lightning payments. I agree. We're telling people we want them to get spinning wallets. We should do something during the show. And DK, maybe this gets back to your ideas, you know, from the Noster News days or whatever, you've been wanting to do some kind of game show or something. We should find some way to integrate into our show something every week where a Lightning payment is involved. It could be trivia, it could be a game, it could be a voting mechanism. But like, if we should walk the walk here. So if you guys have ideas of what you want to see us build, Austin or others, I agree. It's beyond time that we do something with Lightning on the show.
Right.
I agree. I like that.
We've got that prediction market. You know, I built that prediction market software that's up on GitHub. You can actually use. And so we could run a prediction market where people have to predict something, take either side of it, and then we sort of pay out at the end of the show.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we could try different things. I think that'd be interesting to try for next week. The other thing I want to call out is from Vinny, another longtime listener here. And I love this definition. This is great. Talking about as Bitcoin fades in the background. Because at first, the Bitcoin is going to be sad to hear that. But I think his definition is perfect. Quote, Douglas Adams once said, I just moved.
I think a nerd is a person who uses the telephone to talk to other people about telephones.
It's time that we move past the Bitcoin nerds. And I know Steve is the biggest Bitcoin nerd. So the fact that he's saying it's time to move past.
Title to prove it, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm taking my title and just throwing it in the trash.
It served you well, and now we're entering a new epoch.
Okay, let's see. Well, I know we have several more things to talk about. I know the Lightning report. You want to talk about that?
Definitely.
Should we
move to that? Let's talk about that. So shout out to the River team. They always, in my opinion, put out the absolute best Bitcoin research. I think, you know, they're the most trusted name in Bitcoin, and the research backs that up. So they just put out a report. Did you guys see the full report yet? Sort of adoption. Lightning was a part of that. The Lightning piece was what interested me the most. But if you guys haven't checked it out, I think maybe they put it out 2 or 3 days ago, and then the Lightning piece came out a little bit before that. There's a lot of interesting things in there, a lot. Before we get to the Lightning, a couple things I want to call out. You know, one is sort of prices crashing. Everyone's like, is Bitcoin dying? Hopefully not. But their larger point is basically like old school whales still own tremendous amount of supply. And over time, you know, more and more institutions from, you know, treasury companies, traditional companies, funds.
Wow. Just so everyone knows, this is a live show actually at the Golden Gate Bridge. We hear a very loud...
Is that a foghorn?
A foghorn.
There's no fog. You never know. Anyways, yeah, we're doing it live. But his whole point is that basically, like, you know, institutional adoption is happening. We're kind of watching this phase where, like, the early adopters are transferring their Bitcoin to, you know, companies, funds, countries. And, like, that's just kind of, like, sort of expected. And there's a lot of good stats around that. One thing that actually made me very, feel much better about Bitcoin was the hash rate report. I've been spending a lot of time talking with some of my entrepreneurs in my portfolio, you know, many of whom have focused or have shifted their focus more to AI. And I think that's a longer and more interesting discussion. I've also had LPs and people reaching out to me being like, hey, like, is Bitcoin going to die because all of the miners are, like, shifting to AI now? You know, you never know, but probably not. But what we are seeing that's interesting to me is, you know, even though the big sort of, like, public miners and people in Texas are shifting primarily to AI, AI is the buyer of first resort, those ASICs are not just going offline, right? They're getting moved to the edge of the network. And that's, like, a big idea I think people need to understand is, like, if a public company can make more money doing AI training or inference, they should do AI training or inference. Yeah. But then, as I'm seeing, and I'm seeing this from multiple reports, public and private, you're seeing those ASICs then get bought and you're seeing it transfer. And I think one interesting thing to see was, like, the percentage of mining going up into, like, countries you might not expect, like Ethiopia, because they have, you know, this giant hydro dam. And, like, Ethiopia is not going to get underwritten to do AI inference or training for a variety of reasons, at least not anytime soon. And so, you know, it makes a lot of sense now that, like, okay, well, maybe the miners are leaving Texas and they're going to Ethiopia, or they're going to, you know, Brazil, or wherever you have these kind of, like, pockets of, like, really cheap or free energy on the edge, solar farms in the Middle East, like, all these things are going to pop up. And so I think in the long run, that's a good thing because the network gets more decentralized. But, like, it's critical to note that hash rate in the long run, you know, even if it dips a bit, it's not dying. In fact, I thought the most hopeful thing from that whole report was showing, you know, in 2021, I think we were still at, like, 100 exahash per second, and now we're still over one zeta hash. So 10x that.
So just two quick, I mean, one point, just reinforce what you said. It's a good thing if large miners are being distributed to smaller players for decentralization, like you just said.
Yep.
And number two is, it's a completely false argument to say Bitcoin is going to die because miners are moving to AI. Those companies might move to AI, but fundamentally, why will new miners enter? Because profits are to be had. So as long as the Bitcoin, it's a function of the Bitcoin price, and then longer term, it's a function of Bitcoin's usage.
Right.
Because you need Bitcoin transaction demand and you need transaction fees.
Right.
That's all that matters.
Right.
So, I mean, for the next few decades, as long as the Bitcoin price maintains or increases, there will be mining because profits are to be had.
Right.
And then longer term, there needs to be Bitcoin transaction demand, which we've talked about at length on this show maybe 6 months ago.
Right.
And we sort of, you know, game theory scenario planned out, like, well, what if, because there it's absolutely a concern right now that the mempool is near empty. Like, the demand for transactions to fit into the available block spaces is not great right now. There's plenty of time for that to increase, but it does need to increase.
Right.
Or Bitcoin will die. But it has nothing to do with AI. It has everything to do with demand for Bitcoin.
Right.
Yeah, I have a question about this. This may have been asked before, and it may be, you know, some sort of people raise it as FUD. I'm not raising it as FUD. I genuinely am curious about it. But if the Lightning Network were to be very broadly used and lots of channels were already opened on L1 and they didn't necessarily need to be closed, would that reduce demand? I mean, in the long run, is there a chance that maybe we reduce demand for block space?
It's a great question and discussion topic. I always find it funny because I get two different skeptical questions thrown at me
from both ends.
One is Lightning doesn't scale because it takes up too much block space.
Right, right.
If you try to, like, scale it to hundreds of millions or billions of people, it doesn't fit in the block space. There'd be too much demand for block space, too much mining fees. And then on the other hand, I get the question that you just asked. And they're both legitimate questions, but they're literally the opposite of each other. Because the question you asked is like, does it obviate the need for layer one and block space? There will be no demand. So is it there will be no demand or there'll be too much demand? And then there's competing forces for that. So there's no doubt in my mind, a successful Lightning Network that grows in adoption, and we're going to talk about the numbers, and it is growing in adoption, increases the demand for block space. I have no doubt about that. I mean, so personally, I'm in the camp of, I think it will create too much demand, and then, so I'm more worried about the too much demand and high fees versus the not enough demand. The only way there won't be enough demand is simply if people are not using Lightning for Bitcoin payments.
Right. And I mean, to get to that question, I mean, my, and I guess before we jump in the numbers, my bias has always been, I mean, it's all contextual, right? Like in the short run, yeah, maybe it does reduce some activity. But in the long run, I think it's more like Jevons' paradox. Like the cheaper things get, I think it's like net new, for the most part, net new payments you would see on Lightning that otherwise would not have happened.
And actually, maybe something that's maybe not obvious to folks, Lightning scales very well on number of payments, and it scales poorly, or at least not relatively not as well, at number of wallets or users.
Right.
I think number of wallets is a better way to say it, because there might be AI as well. So because the number of wallets you have is limited by the block space on the Bitcoin blockchain, whereas the number of payments you can do, there really is no limit. The only limiting factor there, like if we have channels opened with each other and we want to make payments, they can become imbalanced, and I might have to rebalance it by going on chain, which then gets into scaling issues again. But if you have a naturally balancing wallet, you don't ever have to go on chain anymore. You can do a substantial number of payments, so it scales very well with payments. Whereas like something like Arc or Spark is kind of the opposite. They scale very well for number of wallets, basically unlimited. But if you have high payment volume, then they can start to break down.
When you say less naturally balancing, is that just a feature of sort of how you use a wallet, or kind of what kinds of transactions you're involved in? Is that what you mean? Or is naturally balancing some other term of art?
Yeah, to put it simply, let's say, just take a consumer wallet, and let's say I get paid from my job once a week, and then that income goes directly into my wallet, and then I make purchases throughout the week. Let's say I make 100 units in a week, so I get 100 sent to me, and then over the course of the week, I spend out 100, and then that just cycle repeats. That's a perfect cycle. It automatically rebalances itself. I would never have to go on chain again. That is absolutely a possible scenario, but not everything's clean like that. Let's take the opposite example. Let's say I'm not spending. Let's just say I'm a saver, but I want to take self-custody, and I don't want to, and I'm dollar cost averaging. So every week, let's say I buy $50 of Bitcoin. And let's say on-chain fees are not what they are today, but they're actually like $5 or $10. Well, I don't want to pay $5 or $10 of fees to withdraw every $50 purchase, because that's way too high of fees on-chain. But on Lightning, I might be paying, a tiny micropayment for fees. But in that situation, I don't get natural balancing, because like the flow of funds only goes one way into my savings wallet, and then it just sits there. So right. that scenario is like the worst case scenario for Lightning.
And to be clear, and this is what Jesse was saying, Jesse's in our chat who runs Amboss, a lot of these operators, my guess is very few have balanced channels today. Maybe Block does and a few others, maybe. But in general, my sort of base assumption is that there's more direction one way or another. For example, if you're working with an exchange, my guess is way more people are withdrawing because they're buying to self-custody than they are actually spending today. And so in that world, the node operators do have to do quite a lot of on-chain batching. Like they're batching lots of smaller payments, but they do have to do a lot of on-chain activity to rebalance.
We talked about this a little bit last May when Block reported a very, they framed it as yield, but like a very good financial return on the Lightning node that Block's running. I think it was like 10% was reported. And I think that stunned a lot of people, even in the Lightning Network community, who are running Lightning nodes, because that's much higher than most people are making on their Lightning nodes. So was that fabricated, or how is Cash App, how is Cash App and Block doing that? It wasn't fabricated. It's because they're in a situation of flow of funds where a lot of people buy Bitcoin on Cash App and then they withdraw it through the Lightning Network node. And it it creates the direction of the flow of funds makes the Block Lightning node in an advantageous position because it has a lot of liquidity that it can basically sell to others. So right. I think they use Lightning Labs Loop, or I don't know what all services they use, but they make extra money because of that. Whereas a lot of other wallets are not in that position. They're not sending out more than they're receiving. They're either balanced, which is a great situation to be in, or they take in more money than they spend out, like the savings wallet scenario I mentioned.
By the way, one thing that maybe just is an interesting fact to show you where we are in adoption. Do you guys remember the old school site I invested in way, way, way early in the days and haven't tracked very closely recently, but like Network Plus, did you guys ever use that?
I don't remember.
It's a way for people to read. So there are marketplaces. Amboss is a marketplace. Lightning Labs is sort of a marketplace with Loop. But if you go back to Lightning Network Plus, it's this kind of like jank website. Do you know it was like a way for people to rebalance by like, hey, I'm going to connect to you and you connect to me. And it was like kind of in the old school days of just like triangles and pentagons and all these shapes, if you remember all that, to balance liquidity. I just checked them like, I don't know, a day or two ago because I was curious. Do you know how much Bitcoin volume they've done through that site and rebalancing? Take a wild guess.
Over what period of time?
Since 21.
If you get it wrong, you can always say you meant the other.
Well, I just want to like give a legitimate answer.
5 billion Bitcoin.
See what you did there, dude. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. 10 million?
No. So 2,000. 2,000 full Bitcoin worth. But to give you a sense,
I didn't mean 10 million Bitcoin.
$10 million. So 2,000 Bitcoin times whatever, $70,000. Now they have not yet monetized that, but like just to be clear, like that is just like
It used to be $10,000 in 2021.
Yeah.
All right. So $10 million is probably about right.
So it's crazy. So they still have to figure out how to monetize all that. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But like it just shows me that so much of, even though there are products like Ambosses that, have some volume, Lightning Labs have some volume. I think the reason that old school site still does so well is because it's no KYC. And so that just shows you the old school. The old school whales are still controlling Bitcoin. So just gives you an idea of where we are in terms of adoption. That's going to change. It's going to get there. But anyways, it's interesting.
But back to the report, I think I don't know what all you want to talk about. I know you want to talk about the Lightning
numbers.
Lightning numbers.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So okay. Lightning Network numbers, right? So one of the challenges we've all been talking about for many years with Lightning numbers is because it's a private peer-to-peer, unrouted network. It's effectively Tor, incentivized Tor. What's crazy is you can never know how much is flowing through the network. Like by definition, you don't know. And so I remember in the early days when I, used to be more involved in crypto land investing, and I would be like, guys, like Lightning Network's gonna have volume. They'd be like, yeah, but what's your total volume locked? I'm like, I don't even know what that means. Like it's also irrelevant because this is a capital efficient network where you're shooting, Bitcoin back and forth at the speed of light. But River put out the report in 23, I think, where they showed it was, 1,200% growth over a 2-year period, 18-month period.
1,212%.
And you've always kind of intimated from what you've seen and from what I've seen with my portfolio companies that things have appeared to keep going up at similar rates over that time. Well, I don't know. In the background, I guess while we're all, watching the price collapse and AI take off, no one's really talking about Lightning. Then River drops this stat last week or so showing that it's grown since last year to $1 billion a month being settled in Lightning volume. That's their best estimate, with over 50% of Lightning Network liquidity reporting to them. That's crazy. And I forgot what it was the year before, like 200 million or something. I mean, it's
a substantial increase in.
It's like a 5X?
Like a 5X.
It's 5X for volume.
Right.
And then, well, also interesting to note is the number of payments. I think it was like 5 million and change for the month of November.
Yeah.
Which was up.
So 5 million is the unit payment number?
It's the number of payments. What's the unit? What do you mean by the unit payment?
Yeah, meaning like it's a payment, not a Bitcoin not, value not or something.
Yeah.
So there's like five million payments and $1 billion of volume in last November. And I think the number of payments year over year, I forget if it grew 5x or 3x or I forget the factor. I what's notable though is that the number of payments from the prior year was actually 6 million. So there was a big spike a couple of years ago. So it's still even down from that. And that was the surge of like zaps on Nostr.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and then that, so that was kind of a, I mean, it's still, it's not gone to zero, but it was like a big hit for a period of time. But I think the most notable thing is if you look at the average amount per payment. So if you take the 6 billion divided by the, or sorry, the 1 billion divided by 5 million payments, it comes out to a little over $200 per payment. That's a very high amount. If you look at previous years, it was much smaller. The like 2 years prior, I think it was like $11 per payment. So 11 to 220 or something like that. What's up with that? Well, number one, the
Zapathons.
Number one is Zapathon, right? So the more skewed towards Zaps, those are like tiny micropayments. But I think the second trend here, Jesse's commenting here. I'd love to hear his thoughts as well. Right. He has a really great vantage point on this.
Right.
But the other trend is, Cash App has seen an increase in withdrawals going over Lightning versus the Bitcoin network, to where it's like a very, very material amount of the percentage of withdrawals on from Cash App. Coinbase as well, maybe like a year and a half ago, launched with LightSpark, powered by LDK, to enable Lightning. And they've seen a steady increase in the percentage of their withdrawals. Bitcoin withdrawals on Lightning.
That's great.
And so for those, especially Coinbase, and several other exchanges support Lightning too, but for that use case, that's where you're going to see a higher amount, right? I mean, like, you know, I have like $1,000 of Bitcoin in Kraken or Coinbase and I withdraw it to self-custody. Well, that's $1,000. So
right.
I think we've seen an increase in that, and that's a big reason for the big $1 billion number.
Right. Do you think it's mostly individuals that are just withdrawing into self-custody? Or do you think it's like, I mean, because I've always wondered, when are we going to start to see like high-frequency traders or like whatever come and want to move between different venues?
I'm not, I've always thought that use case should emerge. I'm not aware of any evidence that it's emerged. So I think that's nascent or non-existent. Maybe Jesse would know.
Well, there is that Voltage announcement where they did the $1 million Lightning payment with Kraken.
Yeah, we talked about that though. First of all, I was not amazed. Or I mean, like, of course Lightning can support that. I mean, that's not hard to do.
But if that's true, then maybe there's more of that activity than we realize. Like with people that are posting, I don't know, they're trading between, I don't know, different venues.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not aware of the data, but as you said, I'm also not.
We don't know.
I'm not privy to all the data.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I would say that the data sources I do know of, like some ground truth, makes me I'm not surprised by the River report.
Yeah.
Because I've seen continued steady growth, and I think there's also a substantial segment of payments that are Visa like. In that the amounts are like 20, 30 bucks.
Right.
Median. And which I think is around where Visa's at, which I think is also encouraging.
Totally.
What all is Jesse saying here? We're seeing 28% growth month over month in our Magma liquidity marketplace. So that's a very strong, growth number. So happy to hear that for you guys, Jesse. That's, the different data points I see, that's higher, but like, I'm seeing like, 10, 12, 15% per month. I mean, any of these numbers are very good growth rates, especially, when that River report came out a year and a half ago, the 1,212% over 18 months, I looked at the volume then and compared it to Visa. And I forget what the number was, but it's obviously, it was minuscule compared to Visa. But then I'm like, well, okay, well, you know, we everything starts at zero and has to grow. So how many more 1,212% do we need until it matches Visa or surpasses Visa? And I forget if it was two or three, but it was two or three. So it's like, okay, that's a tall order, but like, you know, once we get one more in, then it doesn't seem that out of the question. So what we've seen since then is
one more
is one more. And it's now like 0.1% of Visa volume,
right?
One in a thousand. So, you know, if you want to be a skeptic or roll your eyes, you can be like, ah, that's negligible. Except what happens if we see that growth rate again over the next 2 years?
Yeah.
And then it'll, you know, if we achieve that, then other people will not be rolling their eyes. And then we do it again, then we catch and pass Visa.
Well, let's do some back of the envelope math, because there's many things that could take that, make it go off. We've talked a lot about agentic payments. That's like a really, really obvious, like kind of like elephant in the room if it takes off. But let's say, you know, we're at $100 billion a month right now. That was the number in the Visa, or the Ripple report per month.
$1 billion.
Sorry, yeah, $1 billion per month. So let's call that. Jesse's saying he estimates $15 billion last year. Let's even be conservative and call it $10 billion. Let's be conservative. So if we 5x again next year, and then 5x again, right? So that would go $10 billion next year. Would be $50 billion the year after that. Again, would be $250 billion. What is Visa doing in total?
Like a quadrillion.
A quadrant. Okay.
Give, so give or take.
We got a few more to go, but still, I mean, if we're at the point where we're settling next year on the order of $50 to $100 billion, like, now this is a real, like, serious piece of the economy.
Yeah. So I find those very encouraging numbers. Yeah, DK?
I was going to say, if you've got anything in your mind about how agents become users of this thing, then all of your models for 2026 are just broken. The last 2 months have just been so insane from software development and from, you know, agent development and stuff, that it's very credible you could even blow out those previous growth numbers, because easily, agents are the ones doing the payments.
Easily.
Like, yep. Visa is easy to beat, in a sense, in a payment, in an agentic wallet world.
100% agree at that point. We still have to make sure that Bitcoin is successful there, but agree with, like,
talk a little bit. Should we talk a little bit about Matt's piece? Because Matt Carollo just...
Yeah, so Matt Carollo on the Spiral team just published a really good post on the importance of for open, specifically open source agents, but I think agentic commerce in general, the importance of the permissionless, neutral, open network that Bitcoin and Lightning represent. And he really emphasizes specifically open source agents, mm-hmm. because the concern he frames the concern in the piece that if stable coins are adopted, they're not as open and neutral and permissionless as the Bitcoin network. And if each major AI model, which is closed sourced, adopts one or more of these stable coins, it can just sort of cut out open source agents, and they can't participate in that economy. It's just sort of a recreation of the existing financial network.
Clear picture of that, because in my mind, you know, it's like you've got major, you know, hyperscalers, and you've got major labs like OpenAI and Anthropic. You know, is the proposal that they're somehow going to control the underlying agents that are allowed to run? Like, meaning if I use OpenClaw in a certain way with a Anthropic Claude key, that agent would be required to use a stablecoin, would be defaulted to a stablecoin somehow?
I think it would be like each major AI company model would introduce their own agentic model, like their own open claw, except it would be closed claw. Like, mm-hmm. like Gemini would have a closed proprietary, but extremely powerful and amazing agent that you could use. And so will Anthropic and even OpenAI. They bought open claw or whatever and promised to keep it open. Okay. Let's assume they keep doing that. They might introduce their own closed source one as well. And then just the consumer experience presented to people is like, I use Gemini or I use ChatGPT. And along with that is this agent I'm using that's closed sourced. And then they partner with Stripe, or they partner with Coinbase. Or if it's Google, you know, they use their own internal cloud universal platform or whatever it was called. And to support payments. And they create a really good UX around that that scales well. Great user experience for everything, for bots, for consumers, for developers, builders. But at the end of the day, it sucks you into that, what will effectively become a very centralized, controlled, concentrated system.
Yeah. This actually reminds me of, I had a really interesting discussion with someone this week who I don't know if they want their piece shared publicly or not, but wrote about sort of using compute as money. And this is part of a larger essay I'm hammering out, thinking about how to price compute and energy, which to me means in Bitcoin. But one of the takeaways from the conversation I had with her was, if one or two or whatever, some cabal of these agentic companies win, or closed model companies win, like I could see a world, I actually don't see the world where like Coinbase or any of these guys or their payment standards have any power whatsoever. Where I do see a world where someone could become a central bank of payments is if the valuable commodity in this century is intelligence, i.e. tokens. And if you're the one that controls the tokens everyone wants, you should be able to create the bank. What I mean by that is Google should be in an incredible position where it's like, I need Google tokens. I can only pay in like whatever standard protocol Google launches. Similarly, if I want Anthropic tokens, I can only pay in whatever, like they can price. They have the commodity people want, so they should be able to create their own. Like if anyone's in a position to create a new stable coin or a new ledger, it should be whoever controls the thing people want, which is those tokens. Now that's scary for that world, because I could totally see a world where Google and Anthropic are just basically like, look, you have to have Google token, or you have to have Anthropic token, maybe Anthropic partners with Tembo and Stripe or whatever. You have to use this token to access our...
When you say token, you're talking about a stable coin like...
Sorry, you have to use this stable coin to access our intelligence tokens, mm-hmm. right? And so in that world, I think that's really, really bad for Bitcoin. You can still have people maybe building wrappers around it and kind of selling it illegally. That could happen. But I think to your point and to Matt Corallo's point in his piece, Bitcoin does extremely well in a world where open source or let's say more freely available intelligence tokens are just out there on a free market. So I think for Bitcoin to do well in this world, we need things like Maple AI, Vora. We need open source models, frankly, to be competitive enough that people want to use them. Otherwise, I could easily see a world where, you know, 1 to 5 central banks emerge and that's the end of the story.
I agree with that concern. And
that's a big concern.
One, and I think that's kind of what Matt is getting at in his post.
Yeah.
So this is not an easy battle to win, but it's a battle that needs to be won. And I mean, one message I'm trying to spread to folks in Bitcoin is, I mean, we can understand why Bitcoin is superior money in terms of its properties and right. long-term potential, and eventually will win no matter what happens in the world. But that could take decades and decades and decades to play out.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the path it's destined on. But I think we are, you know, we're in a position, we can help it win today. Yes. Because it turns out its properties as daily currency and money are a really good fit for agentic payments.
Right.
And so, you know, I think we're starting to see how this is a pitch that doesn't just sell to existing Bitcoiners, but it's a pitch that can also sell to just people in tech, people in AI. And they'll start to realize, oh, we do need payments in AI, and oh, these properties are needed. And oh, it turns out Bitcoin actually has the best properties.
Yeah. I also think it was very interesting. Last night at the meetup, there was a guy I'd never seen before. Didn't strike me as a Bitcoiner. He seemed like an AI guy. And he was basically asking Jesse, he's like, Jesse, will you, will you make me feel better that I just basically bought an expensive Apple, that it was worth it. And the thing that I think he made himself feel better by saying was, he's like, I started realizing if I'm only using cloud services, and this is the oldest trick, or not even trick, this is the oldest thing in the book, right? You get them hooked. First one's free, kid. So Anthropic and OpenAI and Google start pricing very cheaply. And then all of a sudden they now have, you know, monopoly, duopoly, triopoly, if that's even a word, pricing power. And all of a sudden it's like, okay, well, I'm paying $100 a month for Anthropic and now I need them. And so now it's $1,000 a month, and then it's $10,000 a month. And then, oh shit, like it's almost as expensive as a human. And so I think that where he really clicked, and a lot of people clicked, is like the open and permissionless stack is like the check to make sure that like five companies don't just absolutely dominate everything for the next century.
But without, you need more than just having the stack exist. Like it has to be used in meaningful ways. So, part of what I kind of feel like is unanswered from Matt's piece is what is the action? Is it just a call to arms to build more stuff with Bitcoin, or like are there specific ideas of how we move it forward in a more open way?
I don't know. I was reading Justin's comment. Sorry.
Was it a good comment? I can't read the comment. So
one thing that occurred to me, eCash for agentic payments has an interesting feature. The ability to rug the mint. Sorry, you got bumped up. Rug the mint can be protection against your agent messing up. I'm not sure I believe.
And then he says, run your own mint. So it's self-custody. Give your clinker an eCash wallet. If your OpenClaw loses it or causes an error, you rug your own mint. I think more about that. But this does get to something I've been talking to Dustin about, and the idea that like we discussed many, many, many months ago with Bob here, which is like, if you want to run an eCash mint backed by Bitcoin, it seems like this is a good time to have autonomous life. I'm going to be coming back to this autonomous life thing soon. Like, it's time.
Yeah, but I mean, your crazy ideas that
it's
were
not
on the
crazy
show
anymore.
Like less than a year, it's becoming very closer. I mean, we're all
ideas
of us now,
mainstream.
All of us have now like...
Finally. I'm used to being 15 years old.
Our agent to create his own wallet and run its own wallet. So
can we also just take a moment to just like comment on the state of the world? Like things that used to be crazy. Like, yeah, like when I was first saying that 9 months ago, a lot of people thought I was insane. Now it's not that insane. When we had the Type 1 Summit and we had that panel on doing computing and Bitcoin mining in space and then, you know, inference in space, people laughed. Literally, people on that same stage, they laughed and said, oh, this will never happen. 2 days later, Elon, Google, everyone's like, oh, we're going to space. The world is moving faster and faster. And it's just, it's cool, it's exciting, it's exhilarating, but man, is it a weird time to be alive.
That is definitely true. Let's see. So where are we at? We're on the Lightning report. And then
we started about agents
and open agents and Matt. Is there anything else from that post from Spiral and Matt that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it dovetails into another topic that we've been talking about a bunch in our group chat this week, which is, I think, you know, I don't disagree with anything that I read in Matt's post, but I also feel like I don't necessarily know where it's meant to, like, what are we supposed to advocate for? Where does it lead us? How do we actually make that future that Matt is proposing come true? And I think the stuff that we've been seeing, I think we can talk about Unhuman, right? That stuff.
Yeah. It's live.
So,
Nick, are you
in the chat?
Well, there's numerous unhumans.
I didn't want to give away the specific one.
Unhuman.what?
I think some of them, I think, are not meant to be shared yet. But
okay.
Unhuman.dk, is that live yet?
I don't know. That one's not live. But I think unhuman.domains is live, right?
Yeah.
I think you launched and that today. One's allowed to be shared. And there's, I think, a new launch coming up for the drinkable one on Monday, if I recall correctly.
There's a couple of drinkable ones.
Oh, are there? Okay. Well, yeah, and the powder. Okay, we're being very,
it can be mixed.
Very obtuse right now. Yeah. But the point being, like Unhuman Domains is a new website that Nick Slaney from MDK built. And it kind of came out of our use of Ori together because we were using Ori, which is this bot that we can add to our group chat. We were using Ori to add the bot to the group chat. Then we decided to build things that were hosted, built by Ori, hosted on that OpenClaw instance. And then we found we want a domain name for it, and the bot cannot register its own domains. Then the bot is asking us, can you go out and click around on this website and put in your credit card and blah, blah, blah. And so Nick and team realized...
No. What were some of the problems encountered? Like CAPTCHAs and stuff like that? And didn't accept Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But Namesheet does, but then there are CAPTCHAs that it couldn't get around.
Totally.
There's CAPTCHAs. I mean, I think most of them have... you have to register for the thing... And sure, you could get your bot an email, but like those things, it's not always quite as straightforward if you don't have it set up already. So I think the idea of unhuman.domains is a very simple way for, you know, the product is built bot first. Like you can switch the tab at the bottom to see it as a human, but it's meant to be seen as a bot. And it's a website that explains to the bot how it can register a domain, pay Bitcoin, where to hold it, how to get it. And I think that is a great example of a thing that you can really only do with a agentic wallet digital payment kind of tool. It doesn't work with the old way. But I think it's, in a sense, the first thing I can think of that kind of is a, you know, if you say that Matt's post is a call to arms or a call to action, I think the Unhuman Domains is a great example of a, like a first example of a real digital native Bitcoin product, you know, agent native Bitcoin product. So
I agree. And another fun part of that process in creating that, when we discovered that trying to use existing domain registrars ran into all these problems where the bot couldn't do it, I think, you know, I sort of just went back to my old bag of tricks and I'm like, oh, why don't you reach out to the company and try to get them to change and accept Bitcoin payments? And I love Nick's response. He's just like,
now we're going to build it.
We're going to build our own.
Yeah.
We're going to build our own. And just like, you know, and it's, and like within hours, they had their prototype working.
And then like five more within a day or two. I've never, Nick, by the way, like shout out to him and his team. They move. I've never seen a team move this fast.
Yeah.
So I wish every entrepreneur could just be like a fly on the wall in the group chat and just see the way they move. Because I think it would up everybody's game to see how fast they move, how sharp the ideas are, how they go about the kind of brainstorm, ideation, filtering, prototype, deployment process. Like everything happens within hours. There's no idea
that
like, oh, yeah, and the whole thing is so fun.
It's hilarious.
I just wish
dunking as a service in there.
Yeah. And I think if you don't get a chance to see what that kind of greatness is like, you actually can be held back thinking you're working hard, you know, locked in or whatever. You're doing good work. But if you're not moving as fast as they're moving, you're missing the opportunity to do that.
Yeah. Well, one other thing I want to throw out on the Nick thing, I think this is actually quite important, is one other sort of at least kick for me was, you know, DK, you and Matt got me on Replit. When was that? It feels like that was like a year ago, but I think that was last month.
You just signed up a couple weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm already ready to cancel that damn subscription. In fact, I saw it like charged on my credit card. I'm like, what the fuck is that? Oh yeah, I forgot I signed up. By the way, I hate SaaS. I'm so happy to see SaaS. Like, because the whole freaking...
Oh, I thought you said SATs, and that warmed my heart.
Yeah. I've been using Bitcoin more. But like the whole premise of SaaS is just like sign up once and like we hope you forget your credit card's attached to us. Like, it's so annoying. Yeah. Anyways, it's not value for value, right? But, you know, within like days of using Oribot, and I'm sure I'll probably have this experience once I really start playing with Claude Code, which is one of the points Jesse made, which is like, even though OpenClaw is cool, like it's probably just because people haven't used Claude Code yet. And like, yeah, there's some differences because I can't like give it all my permissions, blah, blah. But anyways, but the point is like, the only thing that kept me on Replit at all was because Replit had this super sweet feature where it was just like very easy to get just with your credit card on file, like one-click domain hosting. You don't have to mess with Vercel. You don't have to do any DNS pointing. Yep. It's just super easy.
Now you can do it from group chat.
Bro, and that's my point. I remember I even said that, I was like, Nick, the only thing keeping me, you know, at all in Replit and not doing this 100% is the domains. Now that's solved. So why would I ever go back to Replit? And again, I come back to this in like the broader software story, which I'm sure we'll talk about like where things are going in the world. But like, even though, you know, I like Replit, shout out to those guys, whatever. But like, why would I ever go back to any wrapper on one of these models unless it's in my chat and it's something unique and it's like with my friends? Like, I don't really see how any of these companies that are wrappers around Claude like survive. I mean,
definitely questions now around Replit and Cursor, which is amazing because just a few months ago, I think we were pretty bullish and excited about their future, but you can see how fast things change.
And Matt has gone from a self-described Replit maxi to like a shrug. I don't know. Claude Code's really cool, right?
Yeah.
Oribot's really cool. Group chat coding's cool. Really cool.
I think there's more of these services too. So I think, you know, Unhuman Domains is a first example. I remember mentioning it to Steve on a run. I don't know if I mentioned it to you, Max, but I wish that Vercel and Supabase were also similarly wrapped in a agent-centric way so that, you know, when I use Claude Code, I've just now started trying to deploy to Vercel and Supabase instead of like I was using DigitalOcean before. And I want it to just be able to do all the deployments. If we need new SQL scripts, it can write them. Right now, my agent is asking me to run SQL migrations in Supabase because it doesn't have access to do that. But that needs to get wrapped. That needs to be something I don't worry about.
I mean, like, even companies like Vercel and Supabase, like, what do they stick around?
I mean, if they evolve, well, maybe. Yeah. They need to evolve, right? Like, they need to be agent. Need to be agent first.
I know what I was going to say. Another thing that was in Jesse's presentation last night at the Builder Meetup, he had a slide saying that chat is the last human interface. And, you know, basically websites and apps are going to go away. You're going to learn information, interact with your data through chat. And that can be voice, of course, too. Mm-hmm. And then you still might want to see things, but your AI agent will create the optimized visual for you on the fly based on your request. And I agree with that. And we've been having a similar conversation in other contexts as well, where people are questioning the importance of like Bitcoin design, like for your mobile wallet or like, you know, a traditional app or website.
Right.
And there's been a lot of, you know, historically, Bitcoin's been very hard to use. It's improved dramatically the past 7-8 years. Using like Phoenix or Lexi, those types of apps, I find them to be a good experience. But how much do those interfaces matter in the future, right? I'm probably going to interact with my agent. It's going to have a spending wallet, and I give it a budget, something I'm comfortable with, and give it autonomy and power over that budget to spend. And then it fulfills my wishes, and I have an interface with that agent.
Yeah.
I don't see it any other way now. Like, I feel like now that we've seen that, we've been experiencing it, using it. I don't see any other. So, like, how much does is that the last human interface? And should we just kind of like stop fretting about website design, app stores, etc.?
Apps are dead. I mean, I also just want to make one more comment on this, which I think Jesse's close, but it's not the last human interface. There is one more, and I want to make a call to arms for. And we've said this on the show before. I don't know if this is a company, which I would love to help fund. Maybe it needs to be a foundation, which raises a bunch of money and then becomes a company one day. but what we really need, I think the last, increasingly I'm of the mind that humans and AIs need to merge. And Neuralink is like, obviously, that to me is the last interface, just like a chip in your brain. And that's going to happen. And you're going to see Elon's going to do one. All the other closed source companies are going to do one. That's terrifying to me. I want to see desperately an open source, or as we said on the show before, auditable version of Neuralink. And I don't know if there's a chance to do that as a company, if maybe some like wealthy Bitcoiners need to like, for the good of saving the species or whatever, make this happen. But somehow I think that is where we're headed, and it's coming quicker than I thought. And we need to make sure, if we're going to be putting chips in our brains, there's a way to audit what the hell signals are being sent in and out. That's super important.
Yeah. I'm just checking time, and I can't really run over today. So we got a few, let's talk a little bit about the new, I don't know if it was news or rumors, but like both Stripe possibly acquiring PayPal, Meta.
I didn't hear that.
Oh, you didn't see that?
No.
Yeah.
Wait, but before we jump into news, I want to give one more shout out while we're on the agent thing, because we gave a big shout out to MDK, but I also do want to give a shout out to Albie. Albie has also been moving extremely quickly. Anyone that's following Roland and what they're doing with their bots, they're giving lightning wallets to agents as well. They've launched a bunch of services. The services have gotten retweeted by Peter Diamandis' people. I think Ben Horowitz mentioned it on the Peter Diamandis website. I think they may have even said Elon retweeted. I'm not sure on that. But that's definitely striking in the mainstream zeitgeist, is what Albie has built with their agents. Mailmike.lol is one example where you can try and sort of prompt inject, i.e. fish an agent. We have not done it successfully. I asked our good homie Satbot, who came up with a lot of creative ways. And at first, I got to give Satbot some credit. He didn't want to fish to make money. But ultimately he did. And appears unsuccessful so far. But like, that's the first example I know of in the world of an agent trying to fish another agent for Bitcoin. And could be interesting to see what happens. So just want to give a shout out to the Albie
guys. Good shout
out.
Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. But yeah, a few news pieces. One is it's a rumor. I would guess true that is being explored, that Stripe looking to acquire PayPal. Two, Meta, and again, I forget if this is rumor or it was announced, but Meta is looking to get to come out with a stablecoin offering in the second half of this year.
Called Mibra, I think, is that right?
And then a third A third related thing is David Marcus from Lightspark posted on X in the past few days, you know, saying that Lightspark, maybe not known as a stablecoin company today, but within 24 months will be the leading stablecoin company in the world.
Yeah.
Which is a bold claim. I mean, I think he's in a position, he needs to make that claim and he needs to make that happen. So I think it's, you know, good that he made that claim, but that's a bold claim.
I'd say he isn't typically full of bluster. He's like kind of a reasonable straight shooter.
Yeah. Right? I mean, so, yeah, I think he like legitimately believes he's going to do that. And I'm sure he has a strong plan to deliver that.
Yes, my guess is if he's saying that, it's probably more true than if, you know, other kind of more wild characters would say that.
Yeah.
So it makes me, I mean, I would just speculate, but like maybe he is part of the Meta stablecoin return. Like if he's doing
my 2025 prediction from a little over a year ago,
that was my favorite,
which I struck out, I think, on all but one of my predictions, and I just redid them for this year. Yeah. So a 2026 prediction as well is that Meta acquires Lightspark, and that often starts with a partnership. So we'll see where that goes. But the rumor on Meta getting stablecoins, I forget a part of that hinted at them partnering with Coinbase or Stripe, but I kind of think it did. Mm. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind David Marcus is in there battling and selling Zuckerberg and Meta to go with Lightspark instead of Stripe or Coinbase. So
without like kind of giving, I don't think any of us have any insider info on this, like what would you guys speculate? Let's say he's correct. Today, Lightspark does basically nothing with stablecoins. In 2 years, they're the biggest stablecoin company in the world. What does that mean to you guys?
Well, he also, in a reply on X, stated that they won't become an issuer. Mm-hmm. Or at least that's not part of the plan.
They're going to move stablecoins, but not issue them, yeah.
Yeah, so that suggests that they would get Tether, you know, USDT or USDC, or maybe an unannounced new one. You know, maybe this is all speculation, right? But like maybe Stripe is coming out with their own issued stablecoin and maybe it's exclusive on Spark. But that doesn't make any sense because they're building Tempo right? So that probably is, you know, not true. But, you know, pick another major company, maybe a partnership with Google. But then again, Google has their own universal standard platform or whatever the name. They need a new name because at least I always remember like Spark, Tempo, Base. Those are good brands. Whatever Google's was, not a good brand.
Google chain.
Yeah.
But to me, then that gets to the question of like, are they going to... So the thesis for Lightspark, and I think our thesis for Bitcoin and Lightning Network in general has always been all these other, you know, Tempos and Google chain are all intranets. And by definition, Stripe chain is never going to speak with Adyen chain directly because they're both trying to like get those sweet, sweet fees. So my question is, what is the plan here? It seems like David Marcus sees an opportunity to market make between all of them and bring all of these like crap chains into Bitcoin and somehow be the exchange between them. I don't know what that looks like, but that to me is where I see, that's where it smells like it's going.
Maybe it is something of an interop layer, like what Bridge kind of is, right?
Bridge, but open. Bridge that speaks Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Hopefully David's listening.
Yeah, and if you are, I don't have any insider info. I'm just guessing.
So yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to see how all that plays out. Like, what does Meta decide to do? I think it'll be super interesting, given that they've already gained all that experience from Libra. They undoubtedly have Stripe, Coinbase, and Lightspark selling them. And probably many others as well. I don't know if Palo and Tether are in there, but you know, like a few years ago, that would seem ridiculous because Tether was just seen and positioned as this thing that an American company wouldn't touch. But now there's like Tether US and like Bo Hines runs it, right? I mean, like it's close to the administration, and so that I'm sure they're in there as well, right? So what does and Zuckerberg's. He's not going to want to give away the keys to the kingdom to some other company and have them make all the profits off the future of all financial transactions that are flowing through Meta. So how does he structure a deal where that does not occur. It'll be really interesting to see what happens with that. Same with what Google decides, what Amazon decides. These very, very powerful companies who can call the shots, but they don't currently have solutions.
Yeah. It would also be very interesting to me if Meta, it remains to be seen how competitive their models, their AI models are going to be. You know, for a while, they were making the big bet on open source. Llama 3 was kind of the big thing. And then Meta just, I don't know what happened. They spent all this money and I haven't seen anything since. Meanwhile, the Chinese models are driving open source. But imagine if Zuck knows one thing, he knows how to monetize. So whether he's using his AI or someone else's AI, it'll probably be his. He's going to figure out how to monetize within his properties. And maybe there's Bitcoin payments there. And maybe, just maybe, if he becomes the unlikely savior for open source in the US, maybe he pairs his open source models with Bitcoin payments in the wild too.
So maybe the last thing we can touch on, we can talk a little bit about Block. There's a lot of news.
Do you know anything about that company?
A lot of news yesterday. And certainly emotional for me and like thousands of other employees at Block. So I'm sure people have heard that Block had a major layoff, like around 4,000 people, 40% of the company laid off in one event. I read somewhere it was the largest layoff by percentage of any S&P 500 company in history.
Wow.
So from a percentage basis, very substantial.
10,000 people before, and then a 40% reduction to 6,000.
Yeah. And a few years ago, I think it was 12 plus thousand employees.
Yeah.
So from its peak a few years ago, the company will be about half. So that's substantial news. I mean, I work at Block, so I was not aware of this. So they did a very good job of keeping it tight-lipped. I was unaware, so I learned at the same time as other employees yesterday. And so I wasn't sure how my team would be impacted, like the Spiral team specifically. I wasn't sure how other teams I work with, other Bitcoin teams at Block would be impacted. I later learned that Spiral was not impacted. So for those listening who, follow along with Spiral, what we do and the good things we do for Bitcoin, we're very fortunate, and I feel extremely fortunate that we were not impacted at all. Yeah. So so the way I'm feeling about that is I have a lot of emotions and great empathy for the thousands of the Block employees that were just laid off. And I just feel an even greater responsibility that Spiral needs to deliver and have great impact, because we were fortunate to not be impacted.
Yeah.
I mean, we're already working hard, but I just feel like I feel, three times the energy to deliver and make good on the fact that the company continues to believe in us, value us, what we're doing for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
That's how I'm feeling. And then, for the people that were impacted, we talked a little bit yesterday, Max, about what are they going to do next? Because one of the narratives, how Jack communicated was this was not due to financial distress. In fact, it was the greatest financial quarter in company history.
Right?
Yeah. So this is not a company like on its way to bankruptcy and in financial distress and had to cut costs. It was the greatest financial quarter in company history. Cash App gross profits grew 33% year over year.
Wow.
I was looking at the gross profit for the company. When I started at the company in 2019, it was around $1 billion, little over $1 billion gross profit. And now it's over $12 billion gross profit.
Oh, wow.
So it's over a 10x growth in seven, 8 years. And yet the stock price is flat. It's kind of mind-boggling how the investor sentiment on the company, given the financial performance. Another metric that I was looking at was the efficiency from a gross profit to employee ratio. Because another narrative I saw on the internet was, the AI story that Jack gave was just a cover. Or that it was really due to like bloated headcount and mismanagement of the past 5 years and just used AI as a story to cover. But that doesn't really line up with the the metrics. If you look at gross profit per headcount, even prior to this layoff, Block was very competitive with all of its peers in fintech and in tech in general. And now Block almost stands alone. I mean, this assumes the company is able to maintain and grow its gross profit. we don't have the Tether numbers, but for public companies, Block is now like $2 million per gross profit per employee. And that, the only company I could find that was higher than that was NVIDIA.
Google?
No.
Really?
Block's higher than Google.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's shocking. Block is much higher. Coinbase and PayPal and Shopify and Google and you name it. The only, in fact, I asked a find a company and NVIDIA was the only one that was higher.
Yeah.
Now, this assumes Block can continue to grow its business and customers and make customers happy and grow gross profits. But I guess I don't believe the narrative, well, at least bloated relative to peers. The data doesn't seem to support that. It does seem like the rationale by Jack and the company was AI. So getting back to the point we were discussing, first of all, just we have to think about the human element here. So I feel so bad for the thousands of people affected. And yeah, I didn't know most, but I definitely, there were the people I did know that got let go, there are some very high quality folks.
Yeah.
And really good engineers. So, and even the non-engineers, one piece of advice we have is now you have some time. First of all, take a breath, gather yourself, and get into a good mental state and deal with this sudden change to your life. But then capitalize on what we talk about on the show a lot, which is around building and becoming an entrepreneur, being you single-handedly can be a builder, even if you're not an engineer or a superstar engineer, and utilize your agency to do that. And I was so heartened by it when I came into the office today for the show. There's one guy, Jamie, who worked at Block, and I know Jamie and was familiar with him. And then I saw him tweet, and he tweeted a video just sharing his emotions and how he's feeling today, one day after being let go. And it's a really positive attitude he had on. Maybe you want to share what you're thinking about, could there be resources or events or ways to encourage people on taking the time they have now to experiment with vibe coding?
Yeah. I mean, and I think one thing that, as a context, I did read Jack's Twitter essay or whatever. I thought it was really good. Also, one thought, I mean, shout out to Jack. I think what he's doing is he is the definition of an early mover, right? What he's doing today, probably realistically, most companies are going to be doing over the next year. So it's not like Jack's in a unique position. He saw it early. And I think he, from everything we've seen from him, when he did the AMA here, everything leads me to believe he really believes AI is incredible. And he really believes you can build more with fewer people. And he's really right. Things have changed a lot. He said the essay since December. But also a shout out to him. It's just a good reminder. I don't know if it's because he's a founder or just has some innate compassion or whatever. But it feels like most corporate CEOs are just kind of dicks when they do this kind of thing. And Jack, to his credit, went above and beyond. I mean, giving everyone, 6 months pay, 6 months or whatever it was, healthcare, or I forget the exact numbers. And then an additional $5,000 stipend to put towards what comes next. So all of those things, just a good reminder of he's going to save a lot of money. Probably the company's going to be a lot more lean. But also on the way out, you can do the right thing. And I think it seemed like he did that. So I thought that was very cool. But I think the next thing that would be even one step further, for Jack and for Block, but also for us, and I suggest this with MDK, is, again, this is not some one company event. We're about to see this happen throughout the entire economy. On the one hand, that's really scary, because if you have a mortgage and a family, I totally get it. You're freaking out. Where's the money going to come from? On the other hand, if you have enough of a runway to survive this transition period, then to me, this is also extremely exciting, because it's the old world where, your value came from doing something that someone else told you to do, that world is ending. And, you can be upset about it, but trying to fight and go back to the world, that old world, it's not going to happen. But the new world that's coming is a world where everyone can be an entrepreneur. And I know that sounds like crazy and like it's going to be, and I'm not saying it's going to be easy to get there, but I think something that we're maybe uniquely positioned to do, at least for people that are interested in exploring Bitcoin, is, you know, can we have, and maybe Block gets involved in sponsoring this or whatever, for people that are looking what's next, you know, workshops, like a week-long workshop is what I was thinking here at Presidio Bitcoin or online. I suggested this to Nick with MDK as well. Basically courses where the whole deal is, we're not just going to get you vibe coding, but particularly with stuff like MDK, the goal is by the end of this week, you make your first $100 online and see where that goes. Because I think people are going to be shocked, you know, once they get over the shock of like, oh my God, my old world is dying. Then I think there's the next shock of, oh wait, but in this new world, is it possible I could do even better? And I think the answer is yes, if, you know, if you get exposed to how that could happen.
And early movers have an advantage, right? Yes. And it's super early right now.
Right.
So I do think some of the folks affected, obviously there's a range of emotions right now, but once you get past the suddenness of it, and those who capitalize on this, I think they'll look back and be like, I'm actually glad that happened at that time,
right?
Because it gave me the time and space and room to see this new world, act upon it, and get a leg up.
Yeah, and so I just in terms of what we can do, though, I mean, I think companies like Nick should be doing this too, because there's the Bitcoin angle. But I think it'd be really cool if we found a way to actually like invite some of those superstar engineers in and be like, cool, just come hack with us for a month or whatever for free, and see what comes out of it.
Yeah,
I mean, we've all been, I'm not opposed to the education idea, you know, week-long education idea, but we've also found that through using things like Ori in our group chat, we can very easily build things. We get our first taste of building without almost even thinking about what we're building. And I wonder if, you know, if maybe Nick or somebody else could host a little bit of like an online forum where he just shows people
how easy
it is to build. And you could use an Ori-like thing, but it doesn't necessarily need to be about Ori. It can just show how easy it is to build. And then I think if you start with Ori, you may say, oh, I need more control and upgrade to Replit or Claude Code or some other more sophisticated tool if you really get into it. But I feel like helping almost create like online, lightweight online forums where people can gather and try out these tools without necessarily, you don't even have to swipe your credit card or anything. It's just like show up and start doing stuff, you know, like an online forum to play, and you see stuff get made and you're like, wow, I can participate in a group chat. I can build stuff and then sort of graduate up from there.
I think it's also just worth noting kind of the reality of the world, though. Like, there's going to be obviously frustration. I think the Block is a first mover, but the reality is I think Block stock went up 25% yesterday, something crazy. Like, what the market is saying is that, okay, the old world, the old way of building where humans are told what to do, that world is now a liability. And so I think it was it this week, last week, that Citrini research report came out where basically they're saying this is going to happen everywhere, right? And so on the one hand, that's like, you know, it's scary because that's a big shock to the society. I don't think it's necessarily going to happen all like smooth. On the other hand, I really think for entrepreneurs, frankly, it would be cool if the government, you know, were like able to help. I mean, I'm not holding my breath, but what? Yeah, no.
What do you think they're going to do?
Well, no, I'm just saying, like, if you're about to see a lot of unemployment, you know, I feel like there need to your point, there's like online forums, but I feel like, and again, the payments piece of this is super important as well. Like, there need to be pathways for people to get paid and just see that it's real quickly.
Yep.
Like, you need to be able to go from like in one day, make, if you could go in your first day for like, most people could get some idea out that gets them to $100. I think that would change everything and make, frankly, this transition a lot more palatable for everyone.
And I think people who don't see themselves, they don't self-identify as entrepreneur. They think it sounds scary. It sounds like a lot of risk. There's all kinds of, I think, baggage associated with that. But if you just show up and play and make something and see how easy it is to make $100 online, I think people will be like, I could do more of that. I don't want to raise venture capital, hire a big team, run a company and hit board meetings, but I do want to hang out in a group chat and make things.
But yeah. And also, while everyone who tries this isn't going to become the next like billion-dollar entrepreneur, if you go through that experience, you gain those skills, you start to see this, you're going to be way more hireable by others doing this who are looking to have a very lean organization building. you're going to stand out to them as someone who was able to make $100 in a day.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I almost wonder, it'd be cool to put together like a little curriculum. And by the way, which you guys are all working on, and I see Matt in the chat with I forgot what you're calling it, but the builder thing. Yeah, Flint. Like more examples, not just of cool apps, but it would also be cool, like cool apps. And like, here's a story of like someone that got to $1,000 MRR or something like that. But I could almost see like a little curriculum, and maybe it's something that maybe I'll add to my vibe coding list, but you know, something with like some of the Kevin Kelly essays around 1,000 true fans, and like trying to figure out his whole thing around uniqueness of like, listen, like there is, if AI goes well, and this is something else I think Jesse really hit on yesterday, which is like in the past, all permission and data flow through these like centralized brokers like Google and Facebook and TikTok and blah, blah, blah. But like, if you can really move things back to the edges with people's personal AIs, their own agents, I could also really easily see a world where it becomes like the early days of the internet again, like a bunch of like basically like weirdos and like bizarre niches. And like, yeah, maybe you're not like the next whatever biggest app builder of all time, but there's like 100 or 1,000 people that really love whatever bizarre idea you have. And that's enough to like live a good life. And I think, by the way, one other hopeful message I think people are not focused on enough is, yes, there's this like the layoff piece, but there's also what we talked about, which is coming next, which is deflation in terms of goods and services. And we talked about that a lot on last week's show. But as energy gets cheaper, like in theory, the only things that are still going to be expensive, frankly, are where we've put like regulatory, like for like housing. Like if everyone was just like allowed to like build up housing, like the cost would come down. And same with, you know, that's what's going to happen with food and other necessities. Yep. So I think in this new world, maybe you don't even need to make as much money. Maybe in the old world, you need to make $100,000. But in a world where things get much cheaper, maybe half of that is like more than enough for a high quality of life. So I don't know.
Alrighty.
On that optimistic note,
yeah.
Shall we wrap?
Until next time.
All right.
Thanks guys.
Bye. See you.